Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1065, with Peter Minnick.
Any of these kind of long-held beliefs that seem just kind of baked into the operation, baked into anybody's thought process, should be challenged on a somewhat regular basis, because you know you're not really going to evolve and move forward if you don't kind of push the boundaries a little bit.
Are you ready for It Factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then, join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode is brought to you by Mies. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary IP and stay in sync, giving the culinary team the ability to both create recipes and distribute them from the same platform. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser-accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yield of ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at Owner.com/unstoppable and see why Owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, CEO of Fresh City, Peter Minnick. My man, Peter, are you feeling unstoppable today?
I am feeling unstoppable.
Man. I'm psyched to have you here. I know that you work with Casey Anton, so I don't know if you're a profit first dude, are you?
We are getting into it.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit about that. I know you've worked with Fred Langley with Restaurant Systems Pro.
Yep.
You recently joined Restaurant Unstoppable Network. You said that you were willing to talk about P&Ls and numbers, which gets me excited because I'm frankly not the best with numbers. That's not my strength, and I want to get better, and I want to be able to start talking about numbers and being open book to the world. This is the idea of open book management in your restaurant, but let's get open book with the world and share how we're doing it. So I'm super psyched for today's conversation. I can't wait to dive into it, but let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling with a success quote or mantra. What do you got for us?
So kind of one of the things we say around here at a frequent basis is that's a good problem to have.
Ooh, give me an example of a good problem to have.
Running out of delivery drivers or delivery vehicles.
Right.
Because your business is picking up.
Right.
Good problem to have.
Yeah, good problem to have. And I mean, I think we should constantly be trying to break it.
right? Like pushing the envelope, and like what's going through your mind as I say that?
Absolutely. So with the second, quote saying, what have you, that I was thinking of is, sacred cows make the best hamburgers.
What do you mean by that?
And, you know, any of these kind of long-held beliefs that seem just kind of baked into the operation, baked into anybody's thought process, should be challenged on a somewhat regular basis, because, you know, you're not really going to evolve and move forward if you don't kind of push the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to recognize, because, I mean, our core values here at Restaurant Unstoppable, my second core value after integrity is we are students. And those core values are for me. They're really how we decide who to talk to. And I think it's important to pay that mindset forward of, like, you are constantly learning. And I think we collectively are constantly learning as a society. And, like, there are things that we just know that we used to think were true that we just know aren't true today. So, like, what's going through your mind as I say that?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I love this business. It's always – every day is a different day.
Yeah.
You don't know what's coming down the road. You can plan and have good systems and foundations in place, and that lets you be nimble when things change, because they are going to change. But, you know, Monday's not like Tuesday, not like Wednesday, et cetera.
Yeah. And in a world that's constantly evolving, the best way to do something as the world around us changes, as the technology gets better, the world's dynamic. It's constantly changing. What worked then doesn't necessarily work tomorrow. So I'm really excited to dive in more along that vein as we get further into your story. But where does it make sense to start sharing your story? Take us to the beginning. And
so I started the restaurant business when I was 16 as a summer job. Worked up in the Adirondacks. My family has a house up there, and graduated high school. Went to Syracuse for a year and was
Cornell.
Syracuse University.
Okay, was that in the Carolinas?
No, it's in Syracuse.
Syracuse, New York. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, what was I thinking of? I was thinking of Clemson. I always confuse Clemson and Syracuse for some reason.
Two good football schools.
Yeah, yeah.
But after a year, I was, asked by my parents or told by my parents that I probably should not go back. It was not a stellar – I had a great time.
This isn't a good investment for us at the moment.
No. The ROI on that on that year was very upside down. So I went home. I grew up in Buffalo. I went home, kind of did a little bit of community college, worked in the ski shop that I worked in for a while, and a bunch of us that Christmas moved out to Vail. And I spent 3 years living in Colorado cooking. The guy that I worked for in the summers had lived out there. I had a connection. I started working at a restaurant. The goal was I was going to join the ski patrol. And I made the ski patrol for my second year out there and found out that I could not live on what they paid the ski patrol. And I stayed in the restaurant. And that's the reason I'm in the restaurant now at 56. Is because the Vail Ski Patrol did not pay their patrollers enough money in 1989.
And when you made your break into the restaurant, were you front of house, back of house?
Back of house.
Were you making significantly more back of house working in restaurants than as a ski patrol?
No, but I was making, joining the ski patrol would have, kind of totally put me upside down.
Yeah.
And... I could work nights and have my days free to ski all day.
It's amazing how many people I've spoken to who have spent time in Vail cooking. So was this your first experience working in restaurants?
My first experience working full time in restaurants. Yeah. I mean, other than a summer job. I mean, I was, 19 when I moved out there.
Okay. And you were there for 3 years. And how soon did you start working in restaurants?
Right away. I had a job lined up for me when I got there.
Okay.
And I'd bounce around from a couple places, and I would come back and work in the summers up in the Adirondacks. But after 3 years, that's kind of your lifespan there. If you don't get out in 3 years, you're not getting out.
Right.
So
I saw in 95 you attended the CIA.
Yep.
How long after that was your time in Vail?
No, I was in Vail before that.
Oh, before that?
Yeah, I graduated high school, went to Syracuse for a year.
Sorry, that's what I meant to say. Yeah.
Yeah, so spent 3 years in Vail and came back and then went to the Culinary Institute.
Okay. So you were what, 22?
22, 23, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what made you want to go to culinary school?
After working with some people that had been there, and working in the business, I'd been working at some higher, both casual restaurants and higher end stuff. It just seemed, it seemed like the fastest way to kind of jumpstart, get me to where I wanted to be. So I spent.
Where did you want to be? That vision of where you wanted to be when you were in 22.
At that point, it was, you know, it was fine dining. It was, you know, the executive chef of something.
Yeah. Did you have a dream of ownership then?
Maybe way in the back of my head. You know, I think at that point in my life, I just thought it would be kind of cool and sexy and fun to be the executive chef. You know, I had worked for a couple really good guys that were, you know, bright. They treated people well. They did great food. They knew the business side of the business.
Is this in Vail?
Yep. And but I wasn't really into the business side of the business at that point. I was into the more the romantic side of the business,
right?
And just, you know, cooking great food and having a good time and enjoying the lifestyle.
Got it.
And then I went to school and kind of got schooled.
So was there at this point, are you saying this is what I want to do for the rest of my life?
Absolutely.
What was it exactly about the industry that made you fall in love?
I liked cooking. I loved the creative aspect of it. I loved being able to please people, you know, to give people food that wowed them, that was great. I liked the process of it. The more I learned, you know, how to run a good kitchen, you know, everything from prep lists to par levels, et cetera. You know, as I moved on, you know, later jobs and stuff, building spreadsheets to track production and par levels and usage so that we could go back and figure out, this is way before things like Restaurant Systems Pro or Crunch Time or any, it was, you know, Crunch Time was probably just getting rolling. But, you know, just to be able to track that and understand where your overproduction, overutilization is, et cetera.
So did that come after culinary school, this idea of, like, really paying attention to business, not so much for the creative side, but for the actual, like, the logistical numbers side? Like, when did that start to form
it
up?
It did. So I graduated from the Culinary Institute. I did a graduate fellowship there for 6 months, which is actually where I met my wife, who was doing a fellowship there as well. So we're kind of a dual CIA restaurant couple, if you will. She was bright enough to get out of the business as a teacher now, and she's awesome. But, yeah, so we went from there. Let's see. We lived in Nantucket for a little while. We moved down to New Orleans for a little while, and she's from Newton, so we ended up here in Boston.
Okay.
And my first job here in Boston was for John Harvard's Brewhouse. And we had one location in Harvard Square, and I was hired to be the sous chef for the second location out in Framingham. And I will probably never work with as talented as a group of or I will be super lucky if I ever pull together as talented of a group of people that I worked with in that restaurant group. And I'm still friends with the vast majority of them to this day. And they're, I think we're mentors to each other. But it was a great operation. We grew that over 5 years. We grew that to 14 locations. Well, and, you know, that's when you start scaling up and, growing, that's kind of when you see the need for systems and process.
Right. Yeah. And when you really start to dive into the business and you try to fully understand how to make it work, like, there's no avoiding it. Like, I think this industry, like, allures, or the allure is what you talked about earlier. It seemed from the outside looking in, it seems sexy and cool. But really, in order to make it work, you have to think that the numbers are cool too. You have to understand the value of systems and understand that it doesn't have to be corporate, right? Like, you can have soul and make systems and process a part of your value system and not lose what makes it special. It sounds like that's what was happening in this group.
Absolutely. And what, you know, what I found and what I drove forward was adding the systems and the process to it made the rest of your life so much easier.
You know, get into that.
So, you know, if you're tracking how many hamburgers you're selling on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whatever it is, then, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out what your prep level should be. And, you know, there's no excuse to be running around scrambling, making more hamburgers at 9 o'clock on Saturday night because you didn't prep properly.
Yeah.
You know, that's it at a very basic level, but.
Well, I think too, like, when you start paying attention to the numbers, you can start to gamify the work and you can make it a competition against yourself, you know, like a competition against who we were yesterday. Like, once you start tracking those numbers, you can bring your team in and it becomes a game. You can literally, you're doing sexy, fun work like you thought it was, but now there's a game element to it, which I think is super powerful too. If you know how to really leverage those numbers. So I see that you graduated CIA in 95. You said that you were in Nantucket, you went to New Orleans, and then you were back in the Northeast, just outside Boston, and you were working with this Harvard Square restaurant group. When did that start?
Would have been, let's see, if I graduated in 95, would have been 96, 7.
So you moved around a lot in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like traveling.
And how long were you with this group? I think you mentioned it, but I forgot.
I was with John Harvard's for 6 or 7 years, probably till about 2002.
Okay, because I see in 2002 you left and you joined the Todd English Enterprise.
My dates are off a little bit because I spent a year working for Vinny Testa's, which is another.
So like 2001 is when you would have stopped.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we move on from that, like, I really want to distill, like, reflecting back at that time, what was the name of this restaurant group? John Harvard's Brewhouse. Can you get into, like, the culture of that organization? Like, you know, if you wanted to recreate that magic of these people coming together, being passionate, being talented, embracing evolution, embracing system, embracing the numbers, how did they do that?
You know, I think it came from the top down. The owners were, the founders were guys from Bain Consulting that, you know, Grenville Byford, one of the owners, was a British guy, loved beer, loved food. We were one of the very first brew pubs, microbreweries in Massachusetts. And, you know, there was a very kind of systematic approach from the top down. Louis Salitas, our CFO, was always engaging with the unit level operators on, you know, what makes it tick? What levers do we have that we can pull and tighten things up? Where are there inefficiencies in an appropriate way, not in a just kind of grinding. We got to make more money. There's another penny to get out of here.
What do you mean by inappropriate? I mean, you shared an example of the antithesis of that, but what about, like, the good example of what the appropriate way looks like?
So the good example is to kind of start with what's the goal, right? What's the organizational goal? It's to profit, to make money, so that everybody can share in the profit, so that, you know, we can pay you a decent, generous salary, so that we can pay you a bonus based on performance, so that we can continue to grow the organization. In that case, it was, you know, grow more units to give people more opportunity.
Yes, yes. And I think that's the thing. It's like, what's in it? When you can share the vision for the organization and explain what's in it for you, you know, the collective, the team, and like where, how we can go further together. And I think it's a part, like, you need, I think that's a part that people overlook when they're establishing their culture. They get into a lot of like the woo woo stuff, but they don't ever talk about fiscal responsibility and the significance of being fiscally responsible and having, and why that, like, why it makes us all better when we do that. So would you say you've recreated that?
We have certainly endeavored to do that.
Not easy.
But it's not easy. And certainly we had that pre-COVID. And, you know, we have completely retooled and reconfigured the company post-COVID. And it took us a little while to get back there. But, you know, I'm not an open book expert. I don't pretend to kind of know exactly how open book works, but I know how good management works in terms of sharing P&Ls up and down the employment, you know, with all of our employees.
I think it's that simple, really.
That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally just, it's not so much, and I used to get caught up on this myself. I'd be like, I need to find somebody who can teach open book. And I think it was Ari Weinswag, and I think I went to him, and he's like, it's just open your books, bro.
Yeah.
It's less of a process and more of a mindset of like transparency and like teaching people the game of business. Like, what are you doing in your business? Open the doors, show people so they know how to influence what you're doing.
Yeah. We've always done that at our general manager and assistant manager level. We have in the past 6 months brought that down to our supervisors in the kitchen. And it's great because they are embracing it and taking the opportunity to learn not just the specific numbers of, you know, this is what our food cost percentage, this is what our budget is, this is where we were, this is where we were off, or this is where we won, but also to, you know, understand what we mean by food costs and how the math works, right? I mean, it's you know, it's your purchases divided by your sales. Well, how do we, you know, like mechanically, how do you do that math?
Right.
You know, how you count your inventory, take your purchases, subtract your inventory, and figure out the percentage.
So why did you leave this group? If it was such a great group to work with, what was the reason why you left?
at the end of the day, it kind of failed.
Oh, okay.
They had taken out a lot of venture capital. They tried to expand. And we had... It just didn't produce the profit. It was profitable, but didn't produce the profits that you know, kind of that the VC funding was looking for at the time.
Yeah, and I think that the industry in general has figured out scaling. Scaling has been like a mystery for a while, I feel like, but I think that is becoming easier and not easier, but I think we're getting more information around scalability. So. It would have made sense that it worked locally, but once they tried to take it to different places, it would have failed.
Yeah, I think the strategy was a little bit off just a touch. I mean, we tried to expand into multiple markets without having a real density in each market. So we were in Boston. We went to Hartford, Connecticut. We went to Pittsburgh. We went to Philadelphia. We went to Cleveland. We went to Atlanta. And we only had... Outside of Boston, you know, we really only had two, maybe three locations in one in one market, and it was it's just difficult to sustain, difficult to drive cost efficiencies through the purchasing. I ended up getting out of the kitchen after a few years. And went back to school, went to UMass Boston to get to work on my business and computer science degree. I've got a weird pedigree, weird educational experience.
I mean, I think it's good that you have that element behind you. I think too often people who get involved only focus on the culinary and they don't have that business acumen about them. So, I mean, I think it makes total sense. When did you, were you full 100% in school during this time or were you working on the side?
No, I was working on the side. I about halfway through my tenure at John Harvard's, I went to work part-time at the corporate level I took over all the purchasing and facilities management, and then whilst I was going to school, and then ended up things kind of folded there. And then I went to there was a group of us that went from John Harvard's to the next place I was at was Vinny Testa's. It was a kind of a well-known Boston area casual Italian restaurant chain. And we grew them from in the span of a year, grew them from 4 locations to 8 locations with continued growth plans. And Buca di Beppo at the time came in and offered Marty Bloom, the owner of Vinny Testa's, a pretty significant amount of money to buy his 8 locations. And as Marty told me one time, if somebody's looking to buy, you should always be asking yourself, should I sell?
Why is that?
Because he made a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that's the goal is to build something. And that's what they love. They love building something and they love creating an asset. And then once it gets built, for a lot of people, they start to lose the romance and they want to build the next thing. So that's a great business model. If you're good at building brands and you can build the systems, build the culture and find somebody who to take that over. Absolutely.
Yeah. Or, you know, sooner or later, everybody needs an exit strategy.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point as well. So looking at your timeline here, so you helped scale this organization Vinny's from 4 to 8 in a year, which is crazy. And then in 2002 to 2005, you were with Todd English. You're the logistics director. You did that for 2 years. Then 5 years, you're the GM for Dining In. Sorry. Yep. Yeah, 2005 to 2007. Then you spent a year as a business consultant at Next Event.
Yep.
And then that's... then you had looks like 3 years off, or maybe something going on before Fresh City.
Whilst I was at Next Event, I was at Next Event as a consultant.
Okay,
so I had started my own consulting company.
Got it.
Both operationally and primarily more so on the multi-unit restaurant side. I was an outsourced purchasing department, basically, for smaller multi-units, and I would go and negotiate purchasing deals for them with both distribution deals with, you know, Sysco, US Food, PFG, et cetera, and all the way back to manufacturers' deals.
So during this time, from, say, 2002 to 2008, this 6-year period, how were you evolving as a professional? What was changing within you?
I was working with 4 or 5 different multi-unit restaurant companies at that point and getting some really interesting, great exposure on how different organizations operate. And I observed some great organizations and I observed some maybe not so great organizations.
What were the major differences between the great and not so great? We don't have to mention names.
The great organizations, I think, as I was saying, you know, as we did at John Harvard's and Vinny Testa's, were conscientious about how they treated people. They were as transparent as possible about the goings on and the operations. They ran great, you know, they were fiscally responsible. And they just treated people with class, and they always endeavored to make the right decision. And you know, if you behave that way, by and large, good things come of it.
Yeah. So, what is the result of that, though? What happens when you do these things that you just mentioned? How does that manifest in the business?
I think your employees behave responsibly towards the business and will, you know, many times go the extra mile for the business, and you know, treat the business kind of like it's their own a little bit.
Got it. What was it? So the point of evolution, really, it sounds like you're getting a lot of different perspective and evolving that perspective was helping evolve your values as an operator. I mean, is it worth hovering over any of these experiences, the Todd English, the GM Dining In, the Next Event, before we start to talk about your transition to Fresh City?
They were all significantly different, which was kind of cool. I mean, next, I'm sorry, dining in was interesting in that it was one of the very first third-party restaurant delivery companies. And they started here in Boston, and we're in five different markets before the owner eventually sold to Grubhub for a pretty significant amount of money.
Wow.
But he was doing it with fax machines and pen and paper long before there was an internet kind of thing. And then when I got there, he had just put in his first kind of online ordering system.
Wow.
But he was using direct mail catalogs.
Wow.
So that was that. And Todd English was working for Todd was great. It was interesting. It was a logistics director, which was kind of a title we created to cover pretty much anything. I was in charge of purchasing. I was in charge of, you know, putting out fires, occasionally, literally. yeah, just getting stuff done.
So it sounds like during this time you've become a specialist, you know, and it sounds like one of the things you were grooming yourself to become a specialist with. It sounds like specifically with the purchase ordering and negotiating deals and rates and are you a numbers guy? Is that kind of your thing?
I am a numbers guy.
Yeah,
definitely a numbers guy.
So I mean, how can you speak to that? Or are you going to speak to that later when we start talking about how that all built up and is what today is Fresh City? Like, where does it make sense to pull that out?
I don't know. I mean, numbers just make sense. They don't, numbers don't lie. They're just impersonal.
Yeah.
They don't, they're not mean, but they tell the story.
Yeah.
And they just make sense.
Yeah. I think now is a good time to take a break to thank our sponsors. When we come back, we'll start to talk about your transition to Fresh City. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode is brought to you by Mies. Running the back of house brings a whole suite of challenges, like distributing intellectual property from your chef's brain to your back of house team across all of your locations. Once that information gets distributed, you still have to train your back of house to ensure the recipes are being executed accurately and consistently. Once everybody is trained, you still have to nail down profit calculations, which can be a nightmare when your team doesn't fully understand theoretical food costs, factoring in yields, and unit conversions. Then, once all this is done, you still have to push the information across all of your locations in real time, factoring in the prices that are constantly changing. Are you kidding me? That's where Mies comes in. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary intellectual property and stay in sync as a team. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yields of your ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. We're back, and take us through the transition to this life that you had with how you got to where you are with Fresh City today.
So let's see. I worked for Todd English for a few years, left there, started my own consulting company on the purchasing logistics side, which was a big chunk of what I had been doing for restaurant groups as an employee. And then, There was a gentleman that had been our CFO in a couple of the companies, was putting together a group to purchase Fresh City. This would have been about 2010.
I remember. I think, was this the same Fresh City that had a location in Newington?
Newington, New Hampshire. Yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
I remember that. I used to go there a lot.
You know, they were so Fresh City was originally started in Boston. It was Super Salad, and some people may know Super Salad nationally. It is not the Super Salad that people know nationally. This was Massachusetts based, and the original founder had failed to copyright, trademark, whichever it is, the brand outside of Massachusetts. So he only controlled it in Massachusetts. So when his sons, Larry and Bruce, came along in the late mid-90s and wanted to grow the company after they had gotten out of college, they found out that they didn't control the name outside of Massachusetts. So they freshened up the brand and renamed it Fresh City and opened the first one in Newton in 1998. And, you know, they were instantly Nation's Restaurant News Hot Concept of the Year.
Nice.
And they expanded and grew the company until they kind of hit some economic financial tough times around 2008, 2009.
I was going to say, let me guess.
Yeah, you know, the bubble that burst kind of took out a lot of people, and they had expanded in hindsight, and I really don't want to speak. I'm not intending to speak ill of Larry or Bruce. I knew them. I actually consulted with them prior to becoming involved. They're great, smart guys in the restaurant business still.
But it was a timing thing. If you took out a bunch of money during that time and you were planning on scaling, the bottom just fell out from underneath you. There was nothing you could do.
And at the same time, the commercial real estate rates that they're paying, the per square foot rates that they were paying through the, you know, 2005, those times when things were going nuts, became unsustainable after the bubble burst.
Right.
And rents were insane. So I came in an ownership transition as the vice president in June of 2010, and we ran the company. The guy that brought me in made some questionable decisions and ended up leaving the company. And the owners were kind of looking around for an exit strategy. The company was significantly upside down, and they brought in a consulting company to help them figure out what their exit strategy was, and they couldn't get anybody to buy it. And I looked at them and said, well, for the right amount of money, I might be able to. I might be willing to take this on.
Yeah.
So in February 10th, 2014, I bought Fresh City for $40,000 in cash and a assumption of over $1 million in vendor liabilities.
What is a vendor like? Get into like what that means.
So for example, They were behind paying their bills.
Got it.
So, you know, whoever it was at the time, Cisco or U.S. Food, you know, they owed $250,000 to them.
Oh, wow.
So,
and they kept on delivering food, huh?
They did.
Wow.
They did.
So how do you navigate that? Is there like, do you basically work something out with the vendors and say, hey, listen, I'm the new owner, I'm going to turn the ship around, can you work with me? Can I get on a payment plan? Like, how does that work?
That's exactly it. You know, what can we negotiate? It's, you can have, I only bought the assets of the company. I did not buy the corporate entities, which actually owned the liabilities.
So what do you mean by the assets of the companies?
The assets are the physical assets, the leases, the sheet pants, the ovens, the vehicles.
Got it.
So you know, you go back to the vendors and you say, you can either have 100% of nothing, or, you know, we can work out a deal to get you paid back as much as possible over time, but you're going to have to work with me on this.
Yeah.
And that's what we did.
What do you mean by you didn't purchase any of the corporate assets? Or corporate liabilities. Is that what you said? You said you bought 100% of the
I didn't buy the
assets.
Corporate entities.
Okay. So,
the
LLCs and all that.
Exactly.
So you started from scratch.
Started from scratch.
Got it. Yep. But you kept the branding.
That was one of the assets that was purchased was all the IP, the intellectual property.
Got it. So recipes and things like that.
Recipes, logos, trademarks, et cetera.
Got it. I mean, I'm a little curious to see, and this is where it gets awkward. And I'm like, I recognize it's awkward because like these are people you have relationships with. It's the things that happen probably happen behind closed doors. Like, but there's also so many great lessons in this stuff in terms of like when it went south. We talked about the variables that were out of our control, right? The crash of 08. But what were some of the other things, knowing what you know about business, reflecting back at what they went through, and it sounds like you were close to the company because you were consulting. Like, what are some of the lessons that you can share with us that aren't necessarily exploiting anybody?
One of the biggest mistakes that was made in the initial ownership transition was that...
When you say the initial ownership transition, you're talking about your...
2010.
Okay, 2010. And you came in 2011.
I came in 2010, I think.
So were you a part of this?
This is when I came in as the VP of operations.
Got it.
The new CEO, CFO just kind of started to run with the existing accounting software and never started new books.
Mm.
So through the course of time, invoices that belonged to the old company were paid with new company's money and should not have been.
So that was additional liability being drawn on the income.
Yep. And that was kind of one of the mistakes that was made that led to the downfall of that entity, that business, which put me in the position to purchase the company.
So this is a great example of the kind of detail I'm looking for. Because for me, the big takeaway is if you're looking to acquire a new business, if you're taking over assets, you are owning the business, you are closing the books, and you're starting fresh.
Never, ever, if you can at all avoid it, purchase a business, an entity. Purchase its assets.
Mm.
Because liabilities, by and large, don't follow assets.
Right. And that's one way to look at it. When you start an LLC, you're literally birthing into the world another person that can hold liability and it can be responsible. And that liability stays with the entity, the person, until it dies.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
And then you need to rebirth a new entity that has purchased all of the assets from the old entity.
Correct.
That's a great lesson. And this is why I push.
Yeah.
So any other lessons before we move on?
Without getting into too much detail as to the why, but you're always better off fessing up to a mistake early than trying to hide it.
Swallow the pride.
Oh, is it the, what did they say about Watergate? It wasn't the crime. It was the cover up.
Right.
That got Nixon in trouble.
Right.
If you make a mistake, own up to it early. I tell that to my kids. Right. If you make a mistake, we can move. We talk about that at work here. That's fine. Let's learn from it. What drives me a little bit nuts is making the same mistake more than once.
Yeah, and sweeping it under the rug and then not being able to correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or just not learning from our mistakes, which we're guilty of it. It happens.
It's human.
It happens here. I don't want to say on a regular basis, but it's something we joke about sometimes.
Yeah. So, so you make the choice to buy the assets and to take over Fresh City, and that was in what year was that? 2011?
2014.
14. Okay. So you were with the organization.
February 10th, 2014 is when I signed the papers, and all of a sudden I owned Fresh City, which was 6 retail locations at that point.
6. And how big had Fresh City grown at one point? Where was it in its heyday?
Over time, they had, I think they had 18 locations. I think 15 or 16 open at one time was the largest number.
Okay.
When
was that, before or like right around 2008?
Before. When I came in, and that would have included some of the old original Super Salad locations as well. So when I came in 2010, we had 10 or 12 locations. 10 okay. locations, I think.
Got it. So what was this like, this transition of going from, what was your title before you owned it? Vice President?
VP.
VP?
Yep.
How was it going from VP to owner? What were the challenges with that?
Given that I had the previous CEO had left and I was kind of acting CEO for the last year and a half, it wasn't significantly different.
All that changed was the paperwork.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was, the managers knew that now I was owned the bank accounts and in charge. But we had, by and large, a great team at that point. But, I think what's important to talk about and know here is that when I first came in 2010, let's back up for a second. Just so that we're all on the same page, Fresh City Kitchen, as we're now known, is not in the retail restaurant business at all.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question. How many Fresh Cities are there today?
So Fresh City Kitchen, as we are now constituted, is into corporate catering. All we do is corporate catering. So when I came into the business in 2010, Fresh City was already was doing a significant amount of corporate catering. And as I dug into the numbers, I realized that that was, by and large, that was the golden egg, and that was the key to Fresh City's success. And each location at that time served its own geographic area of corporate catering. They had their own little fiefdoms, if you will. And over time, as we closed locations, some through, leases came up and it didn't make sense to renew them at the rate that they wanted. I lost a couple restaurants from, the lease came up and they just didn't want to have a restaurant in that location anymore, and I didn't have a choice, which kind of stunk because there were some profitable locations we lost that way. But as we shrunk locations, we just kept concentrating the catering down to fewer and fewer locations until we got down to one dedicated catering facility, and that's all we did out of there. We had one. So by 2019-ish, we had one catering kitchen in JP here in Boston, and we had
one JP
Jamaica Plain.
Got it.
And we had one restaurant left out in Framingham, and the restaurant was on a month-to-month lease, and COVID came around, and kind of put a little bit of a mercy bullet into that restaurant. That restaurant was only existing because the $500,000 of catering that they did a year was keeping it at break even or better.
Got it. Sorry, go ahead.
And we were able to we close that. And, at the end of the day, what we joke about a little bit, after turning the company around, we thought we saw the light at the end of the tunnel and we were hitting on all cylinders. And, unfortunately, the light at the end of the tunnel was a COVID train coming at us.
Which is tough because when, you're depending on corporate catering and bring food to office buildings and corporate events, now everyone's working from home.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
It didn't work. We pivoted like many people did, and our pivot was to refrigerated home meal delivery.
Okay.
And that's actually when we changed our branding to Fresh City Kitchen.
Got it. Is that still part of your mix?
No. As business came back, I have a hard time with dates, but whenever COVID ended,
sometime after 2020,
yeah, and business came back. The catering side of our business came back pretty rapidly, as companies were and still are using food as a reason to get people back into the office, and it just didn't make sense for us to kind of work in both channels at the time. We didn't have the band. We only had about 5 employees at that point, myself included.
I think that there's something to be said from working from home. I think that that's good. But at the same time, there's something to be said about being shoulder to shoulder in the same physical space as the people that you're serving the same mission as. There's something, some energy that can't be recreated working away from each other. So I don't think we've figured it out fully how important it is to be with each other in person. I think you have to get away from each other to realize how much you need each other. But what's going on? You're shaking your head. Yes. What are you thinking?
Well, what we have seen in the last, year and a half, 2 years, and, I think we're pretty close to the pulse on this side of things. Companies are not bringing people into the office to just sit in a cubicle or a workstation and stare at a computer. They can do that just as well at home.
Right.
They're bringing people in to have meaningful interactions, is how I put it, So to be collaborative and
strategy meetings, things like this.
Yeah, strategy meetings. Meetings where people can kind of interact and share ideas or hear the same message at the same time. So it's not a coconut wireless kind of thing. And then they're going out and, sitting in front of their computer at their kitchen table to get their work done, kind of thing. And that's one thing that's really kind of helped our business is that, companies are bringing people together generally Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
What happens when people come together?
And they're bringing in food.
Yeah.
Our average order pre-COVID to post-COVID is tripled.
Wow.
So it's that change has been significant.
Interesting. So let's go all the way back. When you purchased the Fresh City in 2014, what was your vision then?
To own a successful restaurant company.
Yeah. And then how long did it take you to realize that you would be better off if you put all of your energy into doing one thing really well?
Probably took me a year before I fully, I knew the power, the financial power of the business catering that we did. It took me closing a couple restaurants and concentrating the catering that those restaurants had done into fewer locations to really understand the efficiency that could be picked up by doing that, losing the overhead and getting the better flow through on that revenue coming through the
places. So you were maintaining the accounts, but you were you're shedding the physical locations and
maintaining the accounts, maintaining the revenue stream, but losing the overhead, losing a lot of the expenses. There were additional expenses, somewhat marginal or incremental, that were incurred. There's certainly more vehicles, more gas, that kind of thing. But the
shifting liability to different assets, but overall decreasing total liability.
Yeah, decrease total expense.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I noticed that around the time that you're making this decision and you're having this aha moment that, a big chunk of your revenue is coming in from the catering. Let's just put all of our resources into focusing on that. I know companies like Sweetgreens and Tender Greens were also starting to make that realization. And they started really shifting their business model to cater towards catering.
Yeah, well,
I don't know if you that was on your radar or not. I know that's a big part of their business model.
Yeah, well, they're smart. There's a lot of money to be made there. Yeah.
And it all started to happen too for them. They were like shifting everything just before COVID. It was around that 2018, 2019. They were making big changes in their operation to go more in on the catering side, because especially healthy food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. So you were kind of ahead of, it sounds like you're ahead of the curve with, you know, fresh food, or like the soups and salads, proteins,
yep,
brought to the office. There was a huge need for that.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of better food for better people.
Yeah. So, what makes sense? Like, you know your story. Like, what were the biggest points of evolution for you during this time? So, you talked about the shredding liabilities and focusing on catering. What else?
Just kind of understanding the catering business at a deep level. You know, we pre-COVID, 2000, even right when I started, when I bought the company, 14, 15, we were digging into things like the geography of our business, where, you know, doing heat maps, where was our business coming from on a, you know, downtown Boston, even on a block by block basis, so that when we were making sales efforts, we were, prospecting in areas that were going to be complementary to the areas that we're already doing deliveries to. We were market segmenting our clients, and, you know, understanding what segments we were making great sales in, and, you know, kind of then identifying similar companies or companies in those market segments that, you know, we assume that if company X is in the medical hospital business, then, you know, hospital XYZ is might be a good client as well.
So you're collecting data on your target market, clientele, the people that seem to want what you have. And it sounds like you're also getting more efficient with your resources and energy. If we're going in this direction, how can we go in that direction with more stuff?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, right? How can we load more onto a vehicle going in the same direction?
So back to your background in logistics of, like, if we're putting money into going there, like, how can we increase payload?
Yeah, how can we increase the ROI on that delivery?
Yeah. What about, I mean, so any, like, were your systems changing, your internal systems changing? Were the points of evolution there?
Yeah, significantly. When I first came in, we were orders were taken on a triplicate carbon copy form. And, you know, every order went on that. And then they would have to get rung into the POS system the day that the order was to be delivered.
Okay.
So it was all pen and paper, hand. It was only rung into the POS system to realize the revenue, not to actually see the order or have a production report or anything like that. At some point, 2017, I think, we brought in a company called Monkey Media.
Okay.
Who has a web-based software platform specific to drop-off catering. And they have been a fantastic partner for us.
Are you still with them today?
We are still with them today. A number of years ago, they actually got purchased by Easy Cater.
Okay.
We are on the Easy Cater platform, and we do a significant amount of business through that platform.
So there's Easy Cater, there's Cater Ease, and there's Triple C. Are those the three that I'm
aware
of?
Well, Easy Cater is like Grubhub for business catering.
Okay.
It's
a marketplace.
Marketplace, thank you. Yeah.
Got it.
And, you know, they bought Monkey Media for their for their system.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm still fully understanding what Monkey Media does. So you went from basically analog, writing things down, and then you would take all that paper, and then you do manual entry into a computer system to actually crunch the numbers.
Just to realize a sale, just to run the credit cards in many cases.
Okay.
So you wouldn't put in 50 sandwiches and six dessert platters. They would just ring in whatever, $150 or $300.
So you didn't know line item exactly what was selling.
Oh, God, no. So, no, that was a very manual process to find that out.
Got it. And when you changed from doing that to Monkey, what was it?
Monkey Media.
Monkey Media. What exactly did that do?
That is essentially, it's a POS system. Okay. Web-based POS system specific to catering.
So the fact that it was web-based, you could go open a browser and then do the entry at the actual point of sale?
Or orders, we can place all our own orders with the back end of the system.
So the clients?
And the clients can order online on the front end.
Okay.
But it's all, just like any modern POS system, you can run great reports on it. PMIX reports, production reports, whatever you want. It's got an AR module to it. So we do a fair amount of business on accounts receivable because it's all, we're dealing with some big organizations that prefer to pay up with terms or prefer to be billed. I like credit cards to the largest extent. Yeah. Like getting paid as quick as possible.
Yeah, I hear that. Okay. So this basically was it was your POS. It was your point of sale. It was
how you
took care of all of your transactions on the front end and how you manage all the inventory on the back end.
Absolutely.
Got it. And that was purchased by
Easy Cater,
which is a third-party marketplace.
And yeah.
So did they not have were they basically buying the technology to be able to
They were buying the IP.
To interface with their marketplace.
Yep. They wanted a back end. They wanted the systems, the database system on the back end to interface their front end with, because it was just a better system than they had.
Got it. And how was that transition when they went from Monkey Media to Easy Catering? Has it been better?
The initial transition was pretty relatively seamless. It definitely gave a lot of people that were on the Monkey platform pause, because all of a sudden you've got an 800-pound gorilla that's out there that's charging a pretty significant commission to do your sales, and they want all your customer data flowing through a system that they own.
That's interesting, because you made this agreement, and that's the one thing that's weird about business acquisition is they get these companies sell all the data too, and then they won't share it with you. Was that the case here?
Well, what we're mostly concerned is we didn't want them peeking into our data to know who we were doing business with so that they could turn around and market.
And steal the business.
Yeah, to them. And to their credit, in the 6 or 7 years since they bought Monkey, they've not.
So the gorilla ate the monkey is what you're telling me.
The gorilla ate them. Yes, yes, exactly.
Interesting.
They still charge a very significant commission to be on their platform.
So has it been fruitful, though? Is that commission worth the business that you picked up?
It has.
That? Okay.
It has. It has definitely been they represent represent a decent chunk of our business these days.
So I think we ended up down this rabbit hole when I asked you, like, what other evolutions has your business experienced? And it's been leaning more into technology. What was the biggest impact that the technology had? And, like, how were you able to track that on your bottom line? And top line, for that matter. I'm pushing the envelope today. This is good. I'm loving what you're giving us.
So one thing... here's a good example. So we were on this. So this starts when we had retail locations that were using both. We were on the Toast platform. We were actually restaurants 45 through 50 on the Toast platform. I had a couple of the guys who were in the C-level suite, Aman and Yi Cheng, were actually pulling Ethernet cables through one of my restaurants.
Oh, that's wild.
On their hands and knees. They're great, great guys. but so we had Toast on the retail side. We have Monkey on the catering side. And I built our own homegrown database system to integrate all that data into one place for sales and production reporting. That's kind of, you know, one of the things I picked up is a computer science major.
Okay, I was going to say, well, I mean, I think our restaurant listeners might get lost in the details of that. But basically, what's the overarching story here?
The overarching story is to have good reporting.
Yeah.
You know, so we knew what we were selling. Back then, we were starting to learn what we were selling 2, 3, 4 days out. Now we know, you know, we can just push a button and have that information.
Forecasts.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what is your – tell me what Freshity is today in terms of tech stack, in terms of – I mean, have you grown? Are you still – are you like – was there a point where you were shrinking and now you're growing again?
So we shrunk down to one location. Okay. Yeah. We have one kitchen and we serve the greater Boston area out of our one location here in Brighton.
And that was 2019? Or 2020 is when you closed the last location, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, so you just one location. We don't have to worry about integrating multiple units at this point.
What has your percent growth been since 2020?
Since 2020, our growth last year was about 100%.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What are the margins like for, like, what percentage wise? Like, what percent margin should a catering company shoot for?
You want to talk bottom line net income? You want to talk, you know, kind of basic food cost?
I'm talking bottom line, like, net income percentage. I mean, if you want to share your numbers, like, I won't make you, but like, if I can get percentages out of you, I'll be happy.
Here's what I would say, on the net income side of things. Not that we are looking to raise capital from, you know, VC, et cetera. But one thing that's been pounded into my head going back to my John Harvard's days is that for a restaurant company to be able to raise capital, you have to be putting in excess of 15% to the bottom line. It's a risky business. There's plenty of other places that are much less risky to make 8, 9, 10, 11%. So if you're gonna put somebody's capital at risk, you got that at more risk. You got to give them a higher rate of return.
Okay.
So I am comfortable in saying that if we wanted to go out and raise outside capital, we could.
Okay.
It's the catering business. Catering is a great business to be in.
So you're making at least 15%. Is that the message?
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. it's a super efficient business. Our average orders, we know four days out.
Well, it's units of work is what it comes down to. Like, you still have to go through the motions to cook 100 things. If, like, for a lunch rush, you still have to go through the same amount of units of work almost to cook 1,000 things. You know, it's more, but, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you still got to be there producing. So now you're just producing at volume.
But I think what margins are probably lost better too. Is that we don't schedule any labor, or we don't purchase any product, or we don't even prep anything unless we know it's already sold out the door.
So, you know, there's no waste. There's no loss.
There's zero waste.
Yeah.
Just about. So it's an incredibly efficient, I look at it as light manufacturing. Not sexy, but, you know, it's delicious manufacturing. but, you know, and that's where the systems come in. So we know, like, it's 2:31 right now, and there aren't many people left in my kitchen. But for the last 3 hours, they were, you know, putting the finishing touches on everything that's going out the door tomorrow morning, so that, you know, when people start showing up at 4:30 in the morning, they're putting stuff it's already trayed up to go in the oven for breakfast baking, and that's going out, and then people are going to show up, start making sandwiches, and they can show up to their station, lift the lids up. The bread's going to be baked for them, and they can just start banging away on it.
Yeah. So I want to make sure I fully understand. When you say 15% should go towards the bottom line if you're looking to bring on investors, and so from what I'm hearing is you are at the point where you're looking to scale fast right now, and it looks like you're bringing on investors, and 15% of the 100% of total revenue coming in is going towards paying – or you're diverting those resources towards the capital that you've asked for, paying back the capital that you've asked for.
I am not Fresh City Kitchen at this point is not looking at bringing on investors.
Okay. I was trying to read between the lines. I don't know if I heard it right. And I'm being vulnerable here because I'm not the greatest at this kind of stuff, talking this language, but I want to get better at it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're willing to talk about it. So what did you mean by 15% goes towards your bottom line?
So you've got to be able to show a 15% bottom line net income number. Because if I'm going to go out and raise money from you,
okay, I think I misunderstood.
Right?
Yeah.
I need to be able to pay you back a return on that.
Got it.
So, you've got to be able to make some money. I've got to be able to make some money. The other guy that I'm going to borrow some money from, or et cetera, needs to be able to make some money. So you need to show a 15% bottom line net income number to have enough money to spread around.
So the way I interpreted that, and which is why I was a little confused, is I thought you were taking 15% of total income and putting it towards growth or putting it towards.
No, I was like,
holy shit. So does that mean you're doing like 40% total net income to have room for like, so that's why I was curious. So you're saying a good target is a minimum 15% on catering.
Yeah. Which is, minimum 15% in any restaurant business.
Right.
Catering, I think, because of its efficiencies, can provide a somewhat higher ROI than that.
Right. What about tech stack? Where is your tech stack today? How's that evolved in the most recent years? Like, what are you using?
Yeah, so we use, we still continue to use Monkey Media.
Okay, actually, we're going to take a break to thank our sponsors. I just realized what time it was. We'll be right back, and you're going to answer that question.
This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. Ugh. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps. And reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website. We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit Owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust Owner.com to power their restaurants online. This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
We're back. And the last question I asked you was to get into your tech stack. And you mentioned you're still using Monkey Media, which is now Easy Catering.
Well, it's owned by Easy Cater.
Okay, but, got it.
Monkey Media is the platform.
Got it.
We use, what else do we use? Our tech stack has been simplified. We use a database program called FileMaker.
Okay.
That's actually a subsidiary of Apple that I've played around with for 30 years plus, going back to when I was in high school almost. And we use that to do some external reporting, to tie some things together. It's kind of our clearinghouse of information. So that ties together our Monkey Media, which has all of our clients in it. But we use FileMaker to get those clients over to MailChimp for our email campaigns. We use HubSpot for our sales efforts. We've just probably been about 6 months since we started working with HubSpot.
What is HubSpot?
That's a great question, and my director of business development could probably give you a much better answer. But it's kind of a clearinghouse of information for clients and sales and et cetera. So it's
CRM.
It has a CRM component to it, but it's beyond that. In that, you know, we load all of our sales information on a per client basis in it, so that Mike has dashboards, so where he can see, you know, who's placing orders, you know, who's been purchasing a lot in the last month, 2 months, 3 months, et cetera, who's falling off. So maybe somebody needs some attention. If somebody places an order on average every 2 weeks and it's been 3 weeks and we haven't heard from them, maybe we need to touch them a little bit.
Got
so to speak.
Got it. Why was Fred Langley texting you earlier today? Are you working with Restaurant Assistants Pro too?
We are. We've been working with RSP for about the past year.
Okay.
I come from a very systematic reporting background.
Did he see my reel that I was coming here or something?
He did, yes.
Oh, okay.
He texted me the picture of it.
Because I didn't tell him. So he saw that, and that's why he's, okay, I got it now.
Yeah.
So how does that, you think Restaurant Assistants Pro, it's geared towards restaurants, but you're a catering company, so get back
to the financial reporting and the labor reporting side of, you know, part of the business are the same.
Exactly.
Being able to have basically real-time reporting for my managers has been fantastic.
Are you using the general ledger with them?
Yep.
Got it.
Yep. We use the budgets. Mm-hmm. We use QuickBooks for Casey. Spark uses QuickBooks.
Yeah.
So at the end of every period, we were on a 13-period financial calendar, which I think is something that every restaurant company should do.
Why?
So we break our financial calendar down into 13 4-week periods. So every period is exactly the same length. Mm-hmm. I've lived in a 4-4-5 financial calendar for long periods of my life, which is, you know, there's 3 periods in every quarter, a 4-week period, a 4-week period, and a 5-week period. It just gets confusing when you have to compare a 5-week period to a 4-week period.
Was it actually a better month, or was it just more
exactly?
Time?
Yeah. Or you know, was there just an extra week in there?
Yeah, exactly.
So we know that we always start our financial calendar the first Monday of the year, so we are always rolling over the exact same 4 weeks. So it gives us really good visibility as to how we're comparing to prior years.
When did you start working with Restaurant Assistants Pro?
Just about a year and a half ago.
And how has that moved the needle?
it has allowed it's really kind of on an operational basis. It's allowed my managers to see on a day-by-day basis how we're performing. Okay. And, you know, using being able to see the weekly reporting, they can know exactly where they are through the course of the week, where they are with their labor, where they are with their food cost. You can't make that stuff up after it's already been spent. So they're able to kind of plan and forecast and make adjustments, bringing people in a little bit later, a little bit earlier, that kind of thing.
Has it made a measurable, does it move the needle to a point where you can see a clear line before and after?
I don't know if I haven't looked at it from that standpoint.
Yeah.
But it is where the line in the sand would be. It has definitely moved the needle.
Okay. Mostly just from the reducing your prime cost of labor.
Yeah, and just giving people visibility. And, anything that you draw attention to and can point out.
What gets measured gets minded.
That's exactly where I was going with that.
Yeah, sure. It's super powerful. I mean, I believe a lot. I mean, I tell this story a lot with Restaurant Assistance Pro. When I first started talking to Fred, he was interested in sponsoring, and he hates it when I tell this story. I said no, because I didn't have testimonials on the show yet. In their defense, their software. So I don't know if you know the story of Restaurant Assistance Pro. Do you?
I do.
So it started with David Scott Peters, who basically collected all this information about how to run a successful restaurant, working in the restaurants, and just being a student. And then he started sharing all these things. And it was essentially like an operations manual. And over time, that evolved from like operations manual to floppy disk, the CD, to now to where it is today as a service, as a software. And I've just been so incredibly just impressed. Like, I asked Fred, I was like, I need testimonials. And he got me a whole army of people who have just were like, it's just night and day before and after Restaurant Systems Pro, to the point where now, like, if I'm going to open a restaurant tomorrow, I'm using Restaurant Systems Pro, not just for the software, but because of the community and the support mm-hmm. that's there. Fred goes live every day. Like, what other CEO does that?
Yeah, like his 30-day intro was the reason we got into it.
Yeah.
It's a total try before you buy kind of thing.
Yeah. And he gives it like he gives so much, and I think that's what I would need as a restaurateur, just because I know that I'm not great. So I'm putting that all through the filter. If you're like mm-hmm. me, Eric Cacciatore, you're a visionary, you're a dreamer, you like the culture side of things, you like dreaming, you like team building and that kind of stuff. The human elements appeal to you, and you suck with the systems, like a Restaurant Systems Pro is literally everything you need to consider. If you follow that guideline, everything is considered, so you can focus on what you love. And you can also delegate and hand it off, because there is a clear way to do it.
Yeah, you can measure it.
Yes.
Yeah, you can, and you can hold people accountable.
Yeah, I'm actually talking to Fred after this interview, and we're meeting one more time before we make our big announcement of what the new future of Restaurant Unstoppable and our partnership with Restaurant System Pro is. So
cool,
super psyched about that.
Very cool.
Yeah, really, really excited. So, anything we haven't discussed in terms of your evolution, big lessons you've learned, things that we need to know, something that you're the person to talk to on this subject. What is that?
I would say that, one of the things that I've always, and this is where RSP comes in, where you can measure things, you can get improvement. The last 2 points of food cost are only found on paper. And this is where we haven't fully integrated this yet.
What do you mean?
This is the theoretical usage component, because
of RSP.
Because RSP doesn't have a native integration with Monkey Media, which is our POS system.
Got it.
We're still working on getting that data in there to get the theoretical usage, and I'm very behind on getting that done, being the owner and the IT director of this company. But it's coming soon, and I'm very excited to be able to have that so that we can compare actual to theoretical usage.
Yeah. And I know they integrate with Toast. So if you're a restaurant that's not using like a Monkey Media for your POS, then that is available to you.
Yes. Oddly enough, we still have Toast. We only use it for its time clock functionality.
Oh, really?
Because it integrates with RSP.
Really?
Yeah. So we've got one tablet, Toast tablet, for, you know, whatever it is, $30 or $35 a month. That's just our time clock.
Got it. You know, RSP doesn't have a time clock solution.
They don't.
Labor management. Oh, okay.
No. I mean, you could do it manually, but you know the labor function of Toast is pretty good.
Right, and I think they're not just limited to Toast either. They have a whole bunch of different POSs that they integrate with, but. I did have some questions that, you know, actually Sean Lyons, who's somebody who's super active in the Restaurant Unstoppable community, somebody who I'd love to get on the show once I'm down in Nashville again, was he's looking to expand on catering. And he came to me, he was asking me questions on, like, how do you know what to pay a catering manager? And, like what does the job description of a catering manager look like? And, like, that's just a new world to him. Can you enlighten Sean?
Yeah.
I think I saw
this on the Facebook group.
Yes.
And responded. There, it all depends on what, what you mean by catering manager.
So every company has a different definition.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have had catering managers back when we had retail locations, and you know they were order processing, they were in charge of production, but we're talking making soup, salad, and sandwiches, mm-hmm. and getting them delivered out. Is this an on-premise location, and this person's going to be in charge of a wait staff and banquet and event orders? Is there liquor involved? I could certainly help come up with an answer for that, but there's just way more information needed to.
What if this company who it's like their primary focus is full service and they want to break off and develop a catering division, right? And they're just getting started and you want to delegate that to somebody. What about that scenario? If you had to ballpark it, like what would those responsibilities look like? And what is like a starting salary for something like that?
If it was going to be here in Boston, which is, I think, a little bit of a different market than you said he's down south.
He's in Nashville, but who knows? Nashville is kind of exploding post-pandemic.
I don't know. You're probably a $60,000 to $80,000 base plus commission.
Okay. And what
if not higher?
What bare minimum job responsibilities is that person doing at that rate?
That person is doing sales, they're doing prospecting, they're doing they're putting the orders together with the client. They're, you know, working consultatively with the client to create the event, to create the menu. And again, I naturally think about this from a corporate catering standpoint, not a social or event or wedding.
I think that's his
standpoint.
Market, though. He wants to get into. He wants to start working with businesses and have standing accounts. I think the one thing that he was talking about too is he wants to start working with apartment buildings and having like a daily order going to apartment buildings in his local community, where it's like these like new like condos and stuff like that.
Individual orders, or
I mean, I don't know. Maybe he would have a very narrowed down like menu, like of 10 items you could or 5 items you could choose from, and then they would just have like a standing order in place for lunch or whatever. Think about all the people working from home, mm-hmm. right? That just don't want to like stop to cook something.
Yeah, almost like a group Grubhub-ish kind of order.
Yeah,
what have you? Yeah. I mean, if he can get the density, the order frequency, that'd be a great opportunity.
Yeah. Yep. What would you do if you're in his situation?
I would go out and look for businesses.
Yeah.
I would go out and drive around and find business parking lots that are full on whatever days you want to do business. Generally, it's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday these days.
What's the best thing you've done to get business from like corporate entities that have already had a caterer?
Offer them great service.
What's great service look like?
Great service looks like on-time delivery and no mistakes on the order. It's, you know, one of the things that we preach here is, and I mean preach, what we deliver is food. What we're really selling is peace of mind and convenience. Because I don't have hard numbers on this, but fully 60 to 80% of the people that are placing orders are not eating the order. They're not eating the food. They're meeting planners, they're admins, they're training coordinators, and they're having food brought in for some event. The last thing that they want to have to do is explain to somebody why the order is going to be 15 minutes late or why you got roast beef instead of turkey. If you get those things right on the corporate catering side of things, the business is pretty sticky.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I don't like
covered,
to,
sorry, go ahead.
I don't like to, you know, spill our secret sauce, but that's not rocket science.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one thing to say it and it's another thing to deliver.
You got to be able to deliver it.
And you share a lot of the tools and resources you're using, the systems, the technology you're leaning on to execute that level of consistency. So you spilled some beans, my friend. I hate to break it to you. This has been a lot of fun, man. We got to wrap it up and I want to ask you some standard questions I ask all my guests. So if there's one thing about your business, your process, your systems, your culture that is truly unstoppable, what is it?
We're nimble. Mm. We try to be never afraid to shine a light at our business and look at it and see if, when, and how we could be doing it different or better.
I love that. So the mission statement is to change the world by inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. Who have you become? How have you personally transformed as a man?
I've learned that you need to be able to walk into your business, own up to the mistakes that you've made, be able to look people in the eye, and, you know, if you've made a mistake, look them in the eye, apologize, tell them it won't happen again, and have integrity on that. And just be true.
I love it. This is the last question. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your catering company would be lost with your departure. With the exception of three pieces of wisdom you could leave behind for the good of humanity and your legacy, what would those three pieces of wisdom be?
So I would say that, one of the things I like to think is, life is a journey. It's not a destination. Always keep your head up.
So is that one or two?
That's one.
Okay.
I'd say that's one.
Got it.
You know, keep your head up, be looking at the horizon, embrace new things, I like to embrace change, which tends to drive some of the people in my world a little bit crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm learning to adopt change better. But I totally agree with you that it's necessary. You got to constantly evolve.
Constantly. You know, you have to be nimble. Yeah. Do your job.
Two.
Is two. Just, you know, have people be able to count on you to just do your job.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, there are a few things that Bill Belichick got right. And his line about do your job, I have to give him credit for.
I love that.
And
three.
Hire good people and get the hell out of their way.
Mm.
Just, you know. Don't make their life, their work any harder. And I'm sure many times I need to take my own lessons to heart and my people want to kill me. But we have a great, great team, great culture here.
Yeah.
And everybody works hard and I couldn't do any of this without them. I've got some people that have been here for 20 plus years.
I love it, man. This has been a lot of fun, Peter. And who do you respect and admire? If somebody was a guest in the show, if you could get anybody on the show, somebody that you would want to hear from and learn from, who would that person be for you?
I would love to hear, I'll give you two people if I can.
Yeah, please.
So somebody I don't know, Danny Meyer.
Oh, man. A dream guest right there.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that guy just gets it.
I'd love to get him on.
And then the guy who hired me for my first job here in Boston 30-plus years ago, Sam Slattery, who is in an ownership group in a bunch of restaurants down in the Palm Beach area, ooh, is a really, really bright, genuine guy.
Was it Sam?
Sam.
Sam, look out. I'm coming after you. Danny, I'm going to be knocking on your door again. I'd love to make it happen. And how can we connect with you? If we've really enjoyed today's conversation, we are inspired by you, we're motivated by you, maybe we want to come work with you. What's the best way to connect?
You know, I am not the smartest guy. They make my email really easy. It's Pete at FreshCityKitchen.com. Or, you know, try me on my mobile. Sometimes I pick up. I always listen to my voicemails. 781-223-8884.
Yeah. And you did just recently join Restaurant Unstoppable Network. You're on the Unstoppable Owners and Operators Facebook page as well. And I don't know if you're planning on making it a habit, but you have shown up to some of our live events, and we'd love to continue to have you there. So.
Yeah, no, I did one last week. It was great. It's always fun to kind of hear what other people, you know, what challenges they're facing, or what questions they have, or where you can chime in.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, the I don't know if you want to call it stereotype, but one of the things that I'm trying to change about the industry is getting people to talk and realizing that this whole industry can go a lot further if we start lifting each other up and just sharing information. So if you're a fan of the show and you want to talk to other restaurant owners who are fans of the show, you know, come join our communities, and thank you in advance. And this is where I say, thank you so much, Pete. There is no questioning, my man. You are unstoppable.
Thank you.
Cheers. Do you guys hear that? It's subtle. It's in the background. It's a little, it's like white noise, but that is my heater. I am still in New Hampshire, but I am getting used to my camper. I have my office all set up, and I'm recording this outro in my camper, getting ready to get on the road. We're so close. I can't believe it's finally happening. We have our last appointment to be road ready scheduled for March 21st. I'm getting the decals on the sucker, and then I am headed south to Atlanta with maybe a couple stops along the way, and then we're going west. And I'm so psyched for the future of Restaurant Unstoppable. And if you guys want to stay connected with me, find out where I'm going, who I'm talking to, and maybe even meet me in person in a live meetup, be sure you subscribe to our Unstoppable Restaurant Owners and Operators Facebook group. If you haven't yet, you want to do that soon, because on March 19th, next week, Tuesday, Fred Langley from Restaurant Assistance Pro is going to be joining me, and we're going to be making some big announcements that I've been looking forward to this day. We needed our new website to be launched to receive all the new traffic that's going to be coming, and that should be going live any day. And by next week, we're ready to announce our big news. But if you're ready to pull the trigger and you want to join our paid Facebook group, Restaurant Unstoppable Network, then be sure, because today actually we had our very first live session Q&A with Tommy Bigneau, the chef owner of Mr. Paul's Supper Club, and that was a great time. Special thanks to Tommy for joining us. Next week we have Johnny Zila, the COO of Candado Tacos, joining us live, and this is literally where the best in this industry are making themselves available to coach the next generation of leaders. So if you want to be a part of our community and part of this mission to inspire, empower, and transform the industry, join the movement and join our Facebook groups. Again, the free group where we're kind of just keeping you up to date is Unstoppable Restaurant Owners and Operators. But if you want to join the live events and meet the people I'm getting on the show and follow up with me with all the leads on the show in real time, then be sure to join RU Network, Restaurant Unstoppable Network. And it's for short, facebook.com/RU Network. And I can't say goodbye without saying thank you to the people who've made this podcast possible. Thank you to Jared Parisi for your behind the scenes work as our editor and copywriter and soon to be producer. I have the feeling it's right around the corner. And then Callan Miola, our community manager, crushing it. Thank you guys so much. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.